This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
But we're not fighting for us, just for the people back home.
Purple Heart Warriors. Listen now by searching for Dramas wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today in Syria. And this question, how should Western countries deal with HTS, the country's new Islamist leadership, a group that they designate as a terrorist organisation and that's still under sanctions because of its jihadist roots? Its leader, Ahmed al-Sharra, told the BBC this week that he wanted to see all sanctions on Syria lifted as soon as possible in order to begin the monumental task of rebuilding the country after more than 50 years of Assad family rule. A call that was echoed today by Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who supported the rebels in their fight to topple Bashar al-Assad. Well, today, American diplomats are in Damascus for the first time in more than a decade for talks with HTS. Let's talk to the BBC's Lina Sinjab, who's in the Syrian capital. And Lina, what are the Americans hoping to achieve, do you think?
Well, I think it is two-sided, demands. The Americans want to make sure that the new leadership with de facto leader Ahmed al-Sharra does not excluding other factions of the Syrian society. They want to see that this is an inclusive government, protecting minority, protects women's rights. They don't want to see an Islamist government ruling the country. And that's also something echoed by many other, diplomats here in Damascus from the West. At the same time, Ahmed al-Sharra and his government want the US and EU sanctions that have been imposed on Syria because of Bashar al-Assad's atrocities to be lifted. These sanctions have crippled the economy and are stopping any aid to rebuild the country from coming in. So it is like two requests from each side, and the Americans and many other countries wanting to see actions on the ground from the interim government to be able to extend help to Syria.
And interesting, you say they don't want to see an Islamist government in Syria, but that is who the US and the other delegations that have been in Damascus, the UK, the UN, France, Germany, I mean, that is who they have to deal with at the moment, isn't it?
It is exactly. I mean, they are Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. They are Islamist. They have Islamist agenda. We've seen how they performed in Idlib, and that's why everyone, not only the Western governments, but also here Syrians on the ground, are calling for inclusive government. You know, Syria has different minority groups, has different ethnic groups. It's not one colored country that should be governed by one-sided government, and that's the challenge to come ahead. Because, they are the ones who succeeded in toppling the regime. They are the ones who have the power, and they have the order and the military. We'll have to wait and see how much the flexibility they're going to show. They've already called for a national unity dialogue conference to discuss the constitution and to discuss how things will move forward. These are things that will not be tested by words, but by actions. Yeah. So the coming period of time is very crucial.
Lina, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Lina Sinjab in Damascus. Well, let's talk a little bit more about those sanctions. The US, the European Union and the UK all impose financial sanctions on Syria, with American measures having the widest reach, but they target different figures and entities. Julian Barnes-Dacey of the European Council on Foreign Relations has been telling me more.
There's, broadly speaking, three blocks of sanctions. One is the Assad regime and those that were close to it. And clearly those aren't going anywhere. Another set is actually on HTS, a new ruling power in Syria, which obviously has former links to Al-Qaeda. So that is an organization that has been listed as a terrorist organization. And then you have a third set of sanctions, which are kind of, broadly speaking, over the economy and the country as a whole, on the central bank, blocking financial services, bans on imports and exports, and so on. Syria is effectively one of the most sanctioned countries in the world today.
Is there any evidence to suggest that this set of sanctions hastened the demise of the Assad regime? In other words, did they work?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason for the regime's collapse is clearly it's hollowing out. And I think that clearly is partly to do with sanctions and the fact that the regime couldn't get the resources. But of course, there's a bigger issue here, which is also that the country is in the depth of a deep economic, socioeconomic, humanitarian collapse. You know, a lot of that is to do with the regime's behavior and it focusing on its own needs first and foremost. But that is also a result of sanctions. So I think we could say that the country as a whole has crumbled in part because of sanctions, and everyone is paying a price for that. And that included the regime, which was clearly in a much weaker position to withstand this rebel advance.
Does that mean then that the pressing need for humanitarian aid into Syria now is being hampered by those sanctions? Is that the main reason why they need to start to be lifted?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, there is a huge humanitarian crisis. As I said, 70% of the country and population in need of humanitarian support. Those sanctions are a huge blockage on getting aid in. Humanitarian agencies need special exemptions to be able to work with Syrian government institutions and so on and so forth. But there's also the question of, you know, the broader economy. And if the central bank isn't an organization you can do business with, it means that there's no private sector. It means that there's no local business. There's no job creation happening. And so the whole country is sinking into this deep morass. And all of that is now compounded by the fact that you have an organization, HTS, which controls the country, which controls government ministries, which is also sanctioned, and which therefore impedes further ability to do trade, to get into humanitarian aid. I mean, these sanctions create huge blockages, and there's an urgent need for some kind of relief there, for some kind of opening, whether it's a temporary measure that just creates some space or the longer term removal of these sanctions.
So how are they going to be lifted, especially as there are direct sanctions on HTS, the de facto leadership now? Will that terrorist designation have to be lifted as a first step before sanctions can be lifted?
So I think there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty over what happens next. I think clearly what can happen most immediately are short-term humanitarian exemptions and waivers. We saw this occur when there was an earthquake in northern Syria last year, where there were some sanctioned waivers which allowed aid to be channeled to HTS-controlled areas of Syria. There is space to do that more immediately. I think the longer-term process, I think Western governments are going to try and leverage those sanctions, use them to put pressure on HTS to ensure that actually it commits to an inclusive political process that stabilizes the country.
So it'll be what, a gradual and sort of carrot and stick approach, will it? That if HTS meets what, certain conditions, perhaps guarantees the rights of minorities, guarantees women's rights, then perhaps a certain tranche of sanctions might be lifted. Is that how it might work?
I suspect it will be, exactly. It will be a gradual process. I think we should be looking to get these immediate exemptions, but then for full liftings and for HTS to be fully delisted and to be recognized, it will really have to comprehensively take steps, lock them in to allow for an inclusive political process.
Julian Barnes-Dacey, Director of the Middle East Programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations. America's principal interest in Syria is the presence of the Islamic State group there. It emerged on Thursday that the US has 2,000 troops in Syria, double what had previously been declared. They're there to stop IS regrouping. But now there's a warning that's already starting to happen because of the recent upheaval. A senior Kurdish commander who played a key role in defeating the group in Syria, General Maslum Abdi, has told the BBC that IS activity has increased significantly in recent weeks. He heads the mainly Kurdish SDF, a force backed by the US. They're also responsible for holding around 10,000 IS suspects in Syria's Kurdish northeast. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, has been given rare access to the largest IS prison there.
It's extremely rare to get access inside these walls. There's iron gate after iron gate. All along this corridor, there are numbered cells. There are guards here, all of them with their faces covered, one standing outside each of the cells. Merhaba. We've been allowed to get a look inside one of the cells, but we've been told we can't speak to the men. The cell is quite full. There are men sitting on the ground, lining both sides, sitting on blankets and thin mattresses. This is the biggest detention centre for IS prisoners. Most of the men being held here were with IS until the group made its last stand. Kurdish security sources tell us they were deeply committed to the IS ideology. What happens to these prisoners is one of the big questions facing this country.
Hello, I'm Orla from BBC TV.
We were taken to meet a detainee who didn't want to be named. He's 28 and hoping one day to get back to Australia. He said he was speaking freely, but on the key questions, he had little to say.
Do you have blood on your hands? Were you involved in killing anybody with IS?
No, I wasn't.
Did you support what they were doing, what IS was doing?
I don't wish to answer that question because it's maybe affecting my case. If you skip that question, if that's okay.
This was IS in its heyday in the city of Raqqa in 2014. It brutalized one third of Syria and Iraq before it was driven out 5 years later. A key role in that defeat was played by the SDF, mostly Kurdish forces backed by the US. General Maslum Abdi, commander of the SDF, tells us IS is now gearing up again.
Of course, since the fall of the regime, there are more factors allowing IS to get stronger. We see it in many areas. They have more capabilities and more chances. The prisons are more dangerous and face more threat of attack. The danger has doubled compared to before.
And the hope has grown in places like Roj Camp. It's a bleak and windswept expanse of tents, home to almost 3,000 women and children, never tried or convicted. They are the families of IS fighters and supporters.
I'm with the manager of the camp. For security reasons, she doesn't want to be named. Can I ask you, what has the mood in the camp been like since the fall of the Assad regime?
They have started to hope and believe that someone will come to free them. They've packed their bags, ready to go. They say, we will get out of this camp soon and renew ourselves. We will come back again, as IS. Even their children have changed after these events. If you pass them by, they will say some slogans and swear at you and say, it, meaning IS, is coming soon. We will come back soon and get you.
There are growing fears that IS will attempt to free its people from camps and prisons here in the northeast. That's just one of the threats facing the new Syria.
That was our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reporting from northeast Syria. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. The United States is facing the prospect of a government shutdown starting on Saturday after a spending bill backed by President-elect Donald Trump was heavily defeated. Members of his own Republican Party were among those who voted down what was a revised proposal. An earlier bipartisan bill also failed after heavy lobbying by Mr. Trump's highest profile advisor and the world's richest man, Elon Musk. His role was highlighted by Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro speaking on the floor of the House.
They write the bill. They post the bill. They agreed on a bill.
They signed it.
And you know what? They got scared because President Musk told them. President Musk said, don't do it. Don't do it. Shut the government down. Imagine. What does he know about what people go through is when the government shuts down?
Well, speaking after the vote, Congressman Eric Burleson explained why he was one of the 38 Republicans who voted against the latest bill.
When I ran for office, I said that I would not vote to raise the debt ceiling. I've never voted to raise the debt ceiling. And I mean, I love Donald Trump, but he didn't vote me into office. My district did. I'm not afraid of a shutdown.
Leslie Vinger-Murray is director of the US and America's program at the London-based foreign affairs think tank Chatham House. I asked her who was running America, Mr. Trump or Mr. Musk?
Well, it's Donald Trump, but clearly Elon Musk has a phenomenal amount of influence. So, you know, he posted, what, over 100 times before that first deal that had bipartisan support didn't come to a vote. He posted that it was a bad deal. He clearly was working behind the scenes and very visibly to crater that deal. He's clearly having a very significant influence over Donald Trump. But let's be clear, Donald Trump is the president-elect. He's already, you know, moving forward very quickly on a number of dimensions, speaking to foreign leaders, nominating members of his cabinet. He's right out in front. I don't think this is a case where Trump is, unwillingly being manipulated. But we've got two very powerful people that are having tremendous influence right now.
All those tweets threatening some in the Republican Party. That sort of lobbying in real time. Have you ever seen anything like that before?
No, I think this is new. I mean, it's new for many reasons. Obviously, you know, social media has continued to have more influence, certainly during Trump's first administration. But we've now got a situation where, you know, the wealthiest man in the world owns a social media platform, has influence over the algorithms, and has a very influential voice. And I think many people are quite frankly concerned, some are afraid. But it is a new fact, you know, in a rapidly transforming context where, you know, democracy operates very differently. We've always had very powerful, wealthy people in the U.S. It's frankly welcomed by Americans. It's part of our DNA. But this is a different dynamic. And we're going to have, of course, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy with the formal role to try and increase government efficiency, the non-Department of Government Efficiency, as it's called. So everybody's going to be watching this. But again, there is a difference between Musk and Trump, but Musk is going to be very powerful.
Just on the efforts to avert this possible shutdown at the weekend, Donald Trump wants the debt ceiling to be lifted for the next few years, and that's the amount that the federal government can borrow. Some in his party think that's profligate, and that's why they didn't vote for the latest version of the bill. What's a little bit confusing to me, I mean, isn't that what Elon Musk believes too, that there shouldn't be this sort of endless kind of spending that just gets bigger and bigger every year?
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S., as we all know, has a very large debt bill. It has to spend. It has to create, it has to extend that debt in order to finance its spending. Donald Trump is, you know, looking to increase spending considerably, largely by extending his Tax Cuts and Job Act when it expires at the end of 2025. But Musk just, you know, has taken kind of a sort of universal opposition to the spending without really paying any attention to what's in it. So they're not perfectly aligned, Trump and Musk. And now we've got this, you know, very, very difficult, frankly, urgent situation where millions of government workers will be furloughed. Those who do have to work because they're in the military, the national security, emergency services will work and they won't be paid. And this is, you know, through the holiday season.
Leslie Vinger-Murray. Now, among the many mysteries of Stonehenge is the question, what was the huge stone circle in southern England for? It's long been thought of as some sort of religious monument. Indeed, it's still celebrated as such, with thousands of people preparing to visit to watch the sunrise on the shortest day, the winter solstice, tomorrow. But what if it's a political monument? That's what Professor Mike Parker-Pearson of University College London, a leading expert on Stonehenge, believes. He's been telling me why.
We're looking at a time in prehistory when politics and religion were two sides of the same coin. I think there's been a misunderstanding for hundreds of years that Stonehenge was some kind of temple. I'm coming around increasingly to the idea that it's really a monument, that it was built to remember, monumentalize. It's particularly the ancestors. And the stones, of course, coming from different parts of Britain, are indicative of where those people's ancestors resided. It might seem odd. Why would you want to put huge stones in your luggage and pull them hundreds of miles? But, of course, we've got to understand that, you know, these stones were more than just objects. You know, these must have been emblems of identity and ancestral belonging. So to actually move them from one part of the country to the other is making a huge statement about joining in and belonging within a wider and larger territorial group.
And in particular, we're talking about the altar stone, which a little earlier this year, it was discovered that that had come from somewhere in Scotland. Tell us what the altar stone is, and also remind us how it was discovered that it had come from so far away.
It's the central stone at Stonehenge. It's the only one that was laid flat. We use the word recumbent. And it was laid right in front of the two tallest stones of Stonehenge that form the Great Trilithon. It's also laid in such a way that its axis is towards midwinter sunrise. So that's going to be happening on the solstice tomorrow. It's a crucial piece of the construction of Stonehenge. And it's geologists who are able to work out the age of the fragments, the tiny fragments of rock that had been incorporated into this sandstone, to realise that it could only have come from the far north of Scotland.
Your theory about why these stones were brought from different corners of the country, that what was that political statement? Was it trying to forge unity or trying to commemorate some sort of unity?
I think what they're trying to do is to construct it. The moment that the altar stone arrived at Stonehenge, as far as we can gauge, around 2500 BC, so that's 4,500 years ago, that's a really pivotal moment in not just British but European prehistory, with the arrival of groups from the continent of Europe. So it may well have been that this indeed was part of a legitimation of the sense of unity, which of course was very much under discussion and possibly under threat, because there were new groups becoming part of the population of Britain.
Archaeologist Professor Mike Parker Pearson of University College London. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half of the programme.
Hello, Jackie Leonard here from the Global News Podcast. Did you know there is an easy way to get new episodes automatically? Whether it's the Global News podcast or indeed any of your other favourite BBC World Service podcasts, just find the show on your podcast app and then just click follow or subscribe. And if you switch on notifications, you'll get a reminder too. It's that easy. Follow or subscribe and never miss an episode.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It is the greatest and most troubling of aviation mysteries. What happened to Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which vanished from radar over the Indian Ocean in May 2014? There have been two big searches for the wreckage, but it's still never been found. Well, today the Malaysian government has authorised a new search by a private company on a no-fine, no-fee basis. Grace Subathirai Nathan's mother, Anne Daisy, was on board MH370. Grace leads a campaign group representing families of the victims. I asked her what might be different about this search.
Yes, there have been. But this one has a different location. They're searching somewhere a little bit different this time, although in the same region generally. And I think there's been more evidence since the last search till this search. There's been some developments in like the search technology, with new debris being found since the last search. So I'm hopeful that like they have a little bit more information this time than they had the last time.
Why is it so important to find the wreckage for you and other families?
Well, for us and the other families, of course, there's always the need for closure. All of the questions that we asked 10 years ago have remained unanswered. We don't know where the plane is, how it ended up there, why it ended up there, was someone responsible, if so, who? So all of these questions have remained unanswered, and until the wreckage is found, we will be no closer to finding the answers to these questions. And also, without knowing what happened to the plane and why it happened, we cannot prevent it from happening again.
How has it been dealing with that uncertainty over 10 years, the not knowing?
It's of course been very, very difficult because the grief has been very complex. Like in my case, personally, I cannot say that I have moved on. I have never been able to refer to my mother in the past tense. I've never been able to say she's no longer with us or anything to that effect, because what are we grieving? We don't even know what happened. So that has taken a toll. I mean, while logically I speak for myself, but like while logically I don't think I'm going to see her again, but emotionally I haven't been able to accept that.
I mean, even if some of the wreckage, you know, a big part of the wreckage is found in this search, I mean, there is still a good chance, isn't there, that you won't get answers to that question why the plane went down.
Yeah, there is, of course, every possibility that even when we find the wreckage, if we find it, that we won't get all the answers to the questions that we have. But it will definitely give us some answers. And at least we will then have found the resting place of the plane and we would be able to say a proper goodbye and fully accept on all levels that there's no coming back.
Yeah, and just finally, I mean, how hard has it also been just trying to keep things going, to keep putting pressure on the government to do things like this, do a new search and stop this being forgotten?
It's just been like a never-ending marathon. It's been exhausting and you are constantly up against what feels like a brick wall with people telling you, oh, just move on, Grace, just stop, Grace. Like, why are you still hanging on to this? And it's really been very difficult for us to try, especially for me, to try and help people understand that what we're doing goes beyond our need for closure and really, really affects the flying public. Millions and millions of people fly every day and another plane could go missing. And I think that that should be something that is avoided at all costs.
And that was Grace Subbatha-Rai Nathan on that new search. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's head to Myanmar now, a country in the grip of a popular insurgency against its military rulers who seized power in a coup nearly 4 years ago. And it's an insurgency that appears to be gaining ground, lots of it, in fact. According to a BBC investigation, the military now only has full control of less than a quarter of the territory. A patchwork of resistance groups and ethnic armies now have full control over more than 40%, and the rest is mostly contested. For over a year, BBC Eye has been following one of those rebel units and reveals that spies within the military are key to those gains. Rebecca Henschke reports.
In a jungle camp near the Thai-Myanmar border, pro-democracy rebel commander Dewa watches over his troops' training.
We rallied peacefully on the streets. They cracked down on us, so we tried to protect ourselves. Later, we thought armed struggle was the only way to counter those who were wielding weapons. That's why we fought back.
He's got a thin physique and wears studious glasses. Definitely doesn't look like the image of a rebel fighter. Yet he's one of the most wanted men in Myanmar.
Around the campfire they sing a song called Stars about fallen comrades. They sing, "We lived in fear for generations. Now is the time to fight." Later, Dewa lies in a hammock under some trees at the side of their makeshift camp and picks up his phone.
Hello.
One of his key weapons in the war. He's talking to a spy, a soldier in the Yangon region. They're known as watermelons, green on the outside, appearing to be loyal to the regime, but inside red, working for the pro-democracy uprising.
Watermelons are vital. Through them, we know the enemy's positions, movements, strengths, and plans. And we prepare our military operations using that.
As well as ordinary troops, Dewa also controls underground cells in Yangon that are carrying out targeted attacks against the regime. He makes another call. This time, it's to one of his cells in Yangon. We're not given the details, but it's clear they're planning an assassination.
We will do it inside the enemy's security parameters. The target is a colonel.
While the underground cell makes plans, Dewa is moving his ground unit. He's received a tip-off from a watermelon about a security post near a strategically located bridge.
We have been told about their capabilities, where their reinforcements will come from, and which route they will use to withdraw.
Dewa deploys his men on the opposite side of the bridge over a fast-flowing river. Sandbags are put in place,
and snipers position themselves. Come quickly and join the people. You have no way to escape, they yell. At night, on the 10th day, they make a final push, using a drone to target the security post. He goes up in flames. They claim to have killed more than 30 soldiers. The regime are aggressively trying to reclaim lost territory and are carrying out sweeps looking for watermelons. If caught, they would likely be killed. But this frontline watermelon says it's worth the risk. For security reasons, his words are being voiced by an actor.
We are meant to protect civilians, but now we are killing our people. It's no longer an army. It's a force that is terrorizing our people. I've witnessed military intelligence killing innocent people. I'm angry. My anger is bigger than my fear.
That report by Rebecca Henschkin. I should say the BBC did ask the Myanmar military for an interview, but they didn't respond. Rebecca's with me in the studio now. Myanmar's not an easy place for foreign journalists to operate at all. Just first of all, how did you get the material and get it out?
Working with a network of very brave Burmese reporters who I can't name for security reasons, but we had a reporter, a cameraman embedded in Dewa's unit, this unit of young fighters, urban youth who are now rebel fighters living in the jungle. So he was following them for over a year, filming those battles, that turning point, but also them, as we heard, sitting around the fire and trying to survive. And then also I travelled to the border with Thailand to meet with Dewa, who we'd been in contact with, and also gain trust to access the opposition's watermelon unit, this unit that is coordinating spies in the military regime. So we had to build up trust with them and then get access through them to different watermelon spies.
And on the other findings about how much the rebels now control and how much the military have lost in terms of territory, now control less than a quarter of the country, the military. How did you come by that figure?
It was a very extensive data gathering project over months. So again, using Burmese researchers and also the data team here in London with BBC Verify. So we looked at the power balance in 14,000 groups of villages. So this is very detailed data. And we looked at over a period of months, looking at who's controlling public services. So things like schools, healthcare, the courts, police, and then also how freely the military could operate. So these figures are not just a snapshot now, but these areas, this 42% that we're saying that the resistance and ethnic armies control, that's areas that the military hasn't been able to operate in for at least 3 months.
It makes it sound like the military edifice, if you like, is about to crumble. But I mean, they've been in power in Myanmar. Well, they've had an iron grip, haven't they, for decades. Are they really that fragile?
I think there's a warning to the data. They are as fragile as they've ever been. This is the least amount of territory that they've ever had since they first seized power in the coup back in the 60s. And we are seeing that this once formidable military is crumbling. It was once described as almost like cult-like in the loyalty that soldiers had to that institution. That's why they could carry out things like what happened to the Rohingya, because they were blind in their loyalty. And now we're seeing that break. There are spies at every level of the Myanmar military, our investigation reveals. But then at the same time, the military has air power. The resistance has no outside support, no air power, whereas the Myanmar military is being sold very deadly weapons of war by China and Russia still. And their willingness to use it against their own people continues. So the warning really is that they remain brutal and they remain powerful.
Rebecca, thank you very much indeed. Rebecca Henschke there. And you can hear the full investigation, the watermelons, if you go to the documentary podcast feed on BBC Sounds or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Now, at least 100 North Korean soldiers have been killed fighting in the Ukraine war. That's according to South Korea's intelligence service. A further 1,000 have been injured. Back in October, North Korea reportedly deployed around 11,000 troops to Russia's Kursk region to launch a counteroffensive against Ukrainian troops there. The BBC's Jean McKenzie spoken to 3 North Korean army defectors to get their insight onto who these troops are and what conditions might be.
In propaganda videos, soldiers from North Korea's elite special forces are seen wading through frozen rivers topless, smashing blocks of ice with their bare hands. The regime showcases them as the toughest of the tough. But according to Hanul, who served as a frontline soldier in the demilitarized zone, that's not the reality.
After our training, nearly everyone ended up suffering from severe malnutrition, and we had to be sent to recovery center to regain weight. Even the special forces soldiers looked weak and frail.
How much military training did you get?
We spent most of our time practicing aiming our weapons without any actual shooting. We only had one live shooting practice, where each of us got to fire 3 bullets.
I've come to meet another defector, Song Hyun, who escaped fairly recently, in 2019. He says that although the special forces do get some more advanced training, they're not frontline soldiers.
The mission of these special forces is to infiltrate enemy lines and create chaos within enemy territory. They're trained to carry out very specialized tasks like assassinations.
Given they have been trained to run these special operations here on the Korean Peninsula, how well do you think they're going to be able to adapt to fighting a war in Russia and Ukraine?
They might lack fighting skills, but I think they'll be more willing to fight than the Russian troops. A lot of these soldiers will have wanted to go to Russia. Serving in the North Korean military is practically like being in a war zone. This gives them a chance to experience life abroad. And for the ambitious ones, it's going to give them a big advantage.
While it's unlikely these troops will turn the tide of this war, they give Vladimir Putin much-needed manpower. And all the North Koreans I've spoken to say it would be a mistake to dismiss them as just cannon fodder. Their loyalty to Kim Jong-un will count for a lot. I ask Hanul what this means for Ukrainian and South Korean hopes that many of them will simply defect.
I think the chances are close to zero. When I was serving in the front line, looking over at the south, it took me quite a long time to develop the desire to go there. Most of the soldiers in Russia won't even know how they could get to South Korea. And if a soldier shows any sign of defection, it's likely they'll be shot immediately.
Because of this strict discipline, Son Hyung thinks it's unlikely many soldiers will even be captured.
In North Korea, becoming a prisoner is considered worse than death. There is even a military song which says, "Save the last bullet, to shoot yourself with."
But despite the risk, a group of former North Korean soldiers is hoping to persuade some to surrender. This is a message recorded by the defector Lee Hyun-sung, who used to train special forces. Comrades, we've been deceived, he says. There is a new path ahead. Lee hopes this message can be played to the men on the front line.
I thought that the familiar voices, like my voice and other voices from North Korea, can impact their psychology and their mindset. If they convince 10,000 North Korean soldiers, they can create a division between North Korea and North Russia.
So talking about 10,000 soldiers defecting, that's very optimistic.
It is unlikely they will defect with the large number, but we have to keep trying.
That report by our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. The French President Emmanuel Macron has been heckled during his visit to the cyclone-hit territory of Mayotte in the Indian Ocean. As he met locals, some booed and called on him to resign. He responded by saying, "I'm not the cyclone, I'm not responsible." Well, he spent Thursday and Friday on Mayotte, 5 days after Cyclone Chido tore through the territory. He said he'd extended his visit as a sign of respect. More than 30 people are reported to have died, but the final number is expected to be much higher as thousands are still missing. Manrufu Eliasir is an entrepreneur and local resident of Mamoudzou, Mayotte's main city.
The situation is chaotic. We are completely isolated and have to deal with this on our own. We know that we are far away from Europe and from France, but we feel completely alone in dealing with this disaster. There has been some aid relief, but it's mainly local people who have been showing solidarity and started to clean up, open the roads, and move away the debris created by destroyed homes, mostly corrugated iron huts. There is exceptional solidarity between people who are organizing this all by themselves. As far as aid is concerned, we are entitled at the moment to 2 bottles of water per person and 1 can of food. It's so laughable. And on top of that, we face a starvation crisis. And at night, we face groups of youths attempting to loot stores and individual homes. And if we try to look ahead, we realize this territory will never be self-sufficient, at least for food.
Manrufu Eliasir on Mayotte. Now, here's something to warm the cockles. Residents of a care home in England have just been named the world's oldest choir. With an average age of 94, they were given their Guinness World Record certificate this week after performing at a concert in Stratford-upon-Avon. My colleague Jane Hill's been talking to Chris Wrighton, who at the age of 90 is one of the choir's younger members, and Jasmine Kessie, care home manager, who set up the choir.
Our voices ring like holy bells. It's Christmas through the years. It's Christmas through the years.
So we came up with the idea of building a choir, and we got all of our region's homes involved in this choir. And we were practicing initially over Zoom calls, and it was going really well. And then I thought, you know, we might be the world's oldest choir. So we had a bit of a research and we saw that it's quite possible that we were the world's oldest choir. We've been practicing every Wednesday and it's just been really great.
And how many members, and do you have to audition or is it for anyone? How does it work?
No, it was open to anybody that wanted to do it. It was completely free to whoever wanted to come along and sing, really. There was no auditions or anything like that.
Who gets to decide which songs you practice and what kind of music you're involved with?
That just came together as a group. We asked the residents what they wanted to sing, what their favourite songs were, and it all just came together that way, really. A lot of them love Away in a Manger and Daisy Daisy and things like that. You know, quite recognisable songs that didn't need much practice, and they all just got together and it came out.
Together with nothing to fear, our voices ring like holy bells. It's Christmas through the years.
So Chris, tell me what you like about being part of this choir.
Well, it gives us the opportunity to meet people from other homes. I mean, most of the people in the homes have got similar problems. So you're meeting people with similar problems to yourself, but with a similar interest, that being music and choral music in particular. So that's where I think the interest came from. But it really comes from a desire to go on meeting people, even in our dotage. And when the thought was put in front of us that we might actually attempt a world record, first of all, we thought it was a bit of a joke. And then later on, we realised it was serious. And now that we've achieved it, it really feels to be quite something.
They have an official average age of 94, making this a new Guinness World Records title. Congratulations.
Oh, how will you celebrate?
Well, I gather there's some pop about somewhere. I've yet got to find my share. I should probably find somebody else has had it by the time I get to it. But, and then I think it's fish and chips on the way home.
And have you always been musical all your life?
I've always loved listening to choral music. I never performed music because I was doing other things. And so it was a bit of a challenge for me. And I'm pleased to say that it's all been worthwhile, very worthwhile.
Do you have a very good voice?
No, not particularly. But of course, in a choir, there's always somebody to cover you up if you go wrong. And we all did a bit of that for one another today, I think. But no, I wouldn't want to perform as a solo performer.
And I think you had a very special guest, actually, today at the big ceremony where it was announced that you were indeed world record holders.
Yes, we did. We had Tony Christie, who sang Amarillo. And
did he sing it for you today?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Fantastic.
And that was also quite something to appear on the same bill as him.
Jasmine, I do want to come back to you because it's lovely. You can just hear in Chris's voice what it means to him and how much people are obviously getting out of the choir. What differences have you perhaps seen it make?
You know, you see a lot of times people are very anxious to come into care homes, very nervous about it. And one thing that they tend to do is isolate themselves away because their bedroom becomes their comfort zone. So by doing this choir, we've managed to get people out of their bedrooms. They eat better. They socialise with each other. It's just been really lovely to see everybody come together as a community. And like Chris said, we get to meet people that are in similar situations and can share those experiences as well.
Yes. And is it going to keep going, do you think? Has it been
absolutely
such a success?
Yeah, absolutely. We're not going to give up now. I've heard mentions of Britain's Got Talent next year, but we'll see.
Chris, what do you think of that idea of Britain's Got Talent? Are you up for being on that?
Well, that depends. We all are, of course. But yes, whatever the home organises, I'm sure they'll find people to participate because, you know, this will be put up in front of them as something outside the home that will interest them and give them an opportunity to do all sorts of things. And having achieved a little bit of success, they'll probably be looking for even more. And so, yes, I'm sure we should be up for it, but whether we're going to be able to do it or not, it remains to be seen.
That was Jane Hill talking to Chris Wrighton, a member of the choir. As I said, one of the younger members. He's just 90. And also Jasmine Casey from their care home who helped set it all up. Lovely stuff. That is it for this edition of NewsHour from me and the rest of the team. Thanks so much for being with us over the past hour. Until the next time, bye-bye.
Hello, Jackie Leonard here from the Global News Podcast. Did you know there is an easy way to get new episodes automatically? Whether it's the Global News Podcast or indeed any of your other favourite BBC World Service podcasts, just find the show on your podcast app and then just click follow or subscribe. And if you switch on notifications, you'll get a reminder too. It's that easy. Follow or subscribe and never miss an episode.